Do you consider yourself a movie buff in general?
Yes.
Yeah, like your whole life?
I watched, so my parents, my dad worked for, before I was born, my dad worked for Montgomery Ward, in the electronics department. Not like in the fixing electronics, but like in the selling electronics. So we had a, so my dad was like the guy selling people like the big TVs and stuff at Montgomery Ward back in the mid 80s. So we had a V8, we got a VCR. My parents got a VCR, excuse me, it was before I was born. My parents got a VCR in like 1986 or 1987.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this, so they were early adopters. So we've, I never remember a time not having home movies, you know, whether it was Disney Vault movies when I was a kid or, you know, we had a DVD player when those became commercially available. We had the Netflix DVD mail service when I was in high school.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I was a big, you know, I grew up on the couch, so I've watched a lot of movies growing up.
Were you
Good and bad movies.
right? Well, yeah. I mean, when you're a kid, it's so hard to know, right? Like you just kind of you go with the wind sometimes, I feel like, especially when you just have, VHS is being sent to you or DVDs, you just have this huge pool to pick from and you don't really know what's considered good or not.
I was lucky. Looking back, I think my parents had just about every Disney Vault film.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I was raised on a pretty, you know, cinematically, I was raised on a pretty steady diet of the Disney, both the deep cuts and the hits.
Sure. So, like, you were watching like The Great Mouse Detective and The
No,
Rescuers. Did you?
I mean, I remember watching the Fox and the Hound.
Oh, nice.
Like
Wow.
we
Yeah.
had like the Aristocats and we had Beauty and the Beast and all of those, and then when the Pixar ones started coming out, we started getting the Pixar ones, and
Yeah.
you know, we were, you know, that was just always, and then we lived, you know, near video rental places and stuff, but yeah, we got the, we played the hits.
Yeah. So doing that, what were you kind of discovering about yourself or your own taste as you were watching more movies and stuff?
So the movie consumption that probably shaped my taste development mentally, both as a person but also as a comedian, is of all things Mystery Science Theater.
Oh, yeah.
Is I remember being in middle school, probably in sixth or seventh grade, and at the time I think the Sci-Fi Channel would have an episode of Mystery Science Theater on at like 9 in the morning on Saturdays. So when I was in middle school, it basically, I transitioned from Saturday morning cartoons to watching an episode of Mystery Science Theater every Saturday morning. Which, looking
Wow.
back, is a very strange, and people should have stepped in and prevented that from happening.
Yeah.
You know, but watching specifically the Mike Nelson episodes, that those are the ones that run Sci-Fi. So that was like the, oh, this is something that's so out of left field and so transgressive, but also extremely funny. You know, that was for me, like as a 13-year-old, 12 or 13-year-old, being like, oh, this is so completely outside of what I've ever conceived of. This is awesome. I love this.
Yeah.
Which encouraged me, and in conjunction with a lot of other stuff, to just seek out the stuff I wanted to find.
Okay.
But by the time I was in
Okay.
high school, I was a, you know, a pretentious suburban dick, watching all of the Focus Features movies that we were all watching in the early aughts.
Right. Like or like Garden State and stuff like
Yes, of
that.
course I love
Yeah,
Garden State, and
yeah. Yeah.
you know, and some of these movies have aged well, and some of them haven't aged, you know, the best.
Yeah.
Motorcycle Diaries, I love that movie.
Yeah.
You know, I Heart Huckabees.
Were you a Kevin Smith kid?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. I
Yeah.
was a Kevin
Okay.
Smith
Yeah.
kid. Yeah, I mean.
Right, of course.
Well, yeah, I, you know, graduated high school in 2007. You know, I grew up watching,
Right.
you know, and then also just whatever was on TV. So, you know, the my one of my favorite genres of movie is it's 2 p.m. on a Saturday and Comedy Central is on.
Yeah.
You know, so
Yeah.
Out Cold and Dogma and Gardens, not Garden State, Ocean County, Orange County, excuse me, Orange County and Van Wilder.
Yeah.
Just the bullshittest of bullshit movies that a person could watch in 2004 on a Saturday afternoon.
Those are the ones made to go straight to Comedy Central.
They were the
It's
best.
funny because I follow the Comedy Central Instagram, and they'll just tell you when like a certain movie's on right now, and it'll be something like She's Out of My League is playing on Comedy Central right now, and I'm like, God, that movie only exists there now. It's for you to scroll through and go, oh yeah, I remember that one.
I had a buddy, a really good friend of mine. We were working together at one point, and we're sitting around on a slow day, and we're like, "Hey man, what's your favorite movie?" And without missing a beat, he's just like, "Basketball." And I'm like, "No one on earth, like, he just had it in the chamber, just no thought, just instinctually. Oh, basketball." And I'm just like, "Who?
That's
Who?
awesome.
Who are you?"
So, is it fair to relate your love of Mystery Science Theater and riffing on movies, making fun of movies? Does that take us somewhere to antitrust? What was your first experience with this movie? What made it stick with you, I guess?
I saw Antitrust in my typing class in eighth grade
Okay.
because I went to public schools and I've seen a lot of movies in school looking back. And we didn't even have to write a paper on it. I think they were just like, here's a movie about computers. Watch this for two classes.
Wow.
And I it wasn't even like riffing on it. I just remember watching it and being, just not even thinking like as like watching it the first time being like, I don't know if this is a good movie, and it's not a good movie. But also there's it's one of those things that like I wonder like how old are you?
I'm 25.
Okay, so you're okay, so you're actually about the age of my brother. I'm 34. So I wonder
Okay.
how this is one of those this is a movie that can only exist in like a 72-month span.
Yeah,
Like
was
this
this
and
coming off the heels of Hackers? Was this around the same time?
so this came out in early 2001. Like January 2000, Dumping Ground season 2001, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So this is a movie that is informed by they it's there's certainly hackers components of people that don't super know what computers are writing and directing movies about computers, but the audiences don't super know what computers are, so everybody just kind of runs with it. But there's also that like
Right.
distinctly Gen X strain of selling out is bad.
Yeah. And
That's one
sticking
of
it to the
the
man a
yeah,
little
and
bit.
the entire ethic is that sort of sell out anti-corporate thing. For a movie that came out on MGM, that was made by MGM. And on top of that, you have a tech thriller that exists 2 years before MySpace, a year before MySpace starts, and social media becomes what it is. So
Yeah.
it comes from a very specific set of circumstances, every single one of which would become immediately dated.
Yeah.
Right, like the entire premise, the thing that they bring the Ryan Phillippe, speaking of dated things,
Yeah. I was going to say really
it's
quickly, I knew nothing about this movie going into it. And in the opening credits from like the editing, I was like, oh, this is 2001.
yeah
And then the cast was like Ryan Phillippe, Rachel Lee Cook, Claire
Claire
Forlani. It
Forlani,
was like, oh my gosh. Like it's
yeah Tim
everybody
Robbins.
that just, yeah, Tim Robbins, who by the way had a great streak of villain roles, like Arlington Road and stuff like that. And he's the best part of the movie.
Yeah, as what if Bill Gates murdered people for code?
Yeah.
What a delightful premise. But at the same time, like it the mo you know I whether by accident or by not, they identify, oh, Silicon Valley is bad, or
Yeah.
there is something nefarious about this sector of the industry.
Well, and this is like pre-Snowden, you know? This is pre like that explosion of like, oh, who owns information and who has access to it, you
And
know?
that's I think the most and that's the that's how this incredible that question or that point is how this really dated movie also is, I think, really timeless or important. Again, by accident, asking the right
Right.
questions, in a movie that is otherwise a very much a relic. but with that very, and it's a very stupid movie.
Sure.
But it has an incredibly smart question somewhere in there of the democratization of information and knowledge.
Yeah, I
But
love that that is a backdrop to essentially make, you know, the 2001 equivalent of the 70s paranoia thriller, right? Like you know, the I'm trying to think, like
are you
those.
trying to think of the Gene Hackman one too?
Yeah, there's the Gene Hackman one. I mean, there's even the 90s ones like The Firm, right, and
Yeah.
stuff like that.
But
But there were like,
the conversation is the movie we're talking about just
yes,
now.
The
That's, yeah.
Conversation. Yeah. And so, but it's, you know, super updated for like that specific moment. But I think that's kind of what makes it beautiful, you know, is you go through like, what were we paranoid about in the 70s? What were we paranoid about in the 80s, the
Yeah.
90s? You know, and it's just like it's a relic, like you said, of that, you know, cultural moment that, like you said, would change within the year.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, 9/11. I mean,
Right.
8 months later, 9 months later, but it is, yeah, it's so dumb, but accidentally smart, right? Like it just
Yeah.
finds that. And I don't know if it's set dressing that they just were like, okay, we have this tech thriller, and what's a good tension that would exist in Silicon Valley, and also we're all Gen Xers. Yeah, they're afraid of
Right.
selling out, and they all have, they all look grungy as hell because this takes place in Portland, Oregon,
Right.
and was filmed in British Columbia.
They're working out
So,
of a garage, you know. Yeah.
but they're not. None of them are, But this is before Amazon. This is before PayPal. So, all of the Silicon Valley ghouls that we now, are haunted by. This is before all of them. This is before who's the other chud from PayPal? Not Elon Musk, the other one. Peter Steele.
Yeah. Well, what's especially interesting too is like in 2001, what kind of figure is Bill Gates? He's a pretty heroic like figure, right? He's not controversial in the way that maybe he is now in the culture war and stuff like that. And so this depiction of like an evil Bill Gates with Tim Robbins' character is it's a little like, I don't know. I like, there's a part of me that's just like, it reminds me of like Charles Foster Kane with you know, what's his name? Who felt like it was a depiction of him, you know, where it's like, did
Yeah,
Bill
citizen.
Gates see this movie and go like, are they implying I'm killing people? Like,
I mean, him or Steve Jobs.
yeah, Steve Jobs as well. Yeah.
And I think and that really speaks to Apple's position in the industry is that it was more about Bill Gates than Steve Jobs, because Steve Jobs is such a more obvious character to play as a serial killer than Bill Gates.
Yes. Yeah.
Because of the forced eccentricities and the I'm going to wear
Yes.
the same, all of that stuff, all of that. Bill Gates, to his credit, Bill Gates never seemed to be that interested in the mystique of Bill Gates the way that somebody like a Steve Jobs and
Right. Or then an Elon, finally, you know,
well
you get to
but I
like,
mean those guys
it
are
just
all
keeps progressing.
Yeah, those guys are all cribbing Steve Jobs. I mean, that was the whole point of Theranos, or
Right.
Theranos, right? Is that Elizabeth
Right.
Holmes was copying Steve Jobs, and all of these Silicon Valley guys want to come off as like the weird, off-putting genius nerds, and not people that have some social graces.
Yeah, so I want to get into sort of a little bit of like what the setup is here, where we meet Ryan Phillippe's character. He's working out of a garage doing tech stuff with his buddies, and I'm not tech savvy at all.
Me
So
neither. Me neither. No idea.
some of the so, right, the dialogue is basically gibberish, but I'm invested in the delivery by the actors. You know, I'm like, this sounds important.
It
And then
reminds me of I remember watching an interview with LeVar Burton talking
oh,
about
yeah.
Star Trek Next Generation. And somebody was like, how did you memorize all of those? Was it difficult to memorize all of the technical terms when you were, rehearsing? And they're like, yeah, when we would rehearse, they usually didn't even have those terms written out. So we would just say tech, right? Like, oh, the tech is teching. We need to fix the tech. Right, and that's how they would like get the pacing down and the blocking down for their rehearsals is they would just say tech. So whenever in antitrust they're talking about computers, I just hear, "Oh yeah, the tech is teching. We need to tech it."
It's a lot of that. There's a lot of, oh, I'm gonna computer the shit out of this.
Yeah.
But he ends up, I like that initial scene where they're watching Tim Robbins on the the live stream, and then he calls Ryan Phillippe, and that's immediately your key into like kind of how absurd and over the top the movie's gonna be. Asks him to come work for him. That causes a rift between Ryan Phillippe and his friend Teddy. And then one of my favorite moments is like, just in case you weren't suspicious, we're introduced to Richard Roundtree as a guy from the Department of Justice, and he's just like, hey, if you see anything over there that rubs you the wrong way, just let me know. So now that seed's planted, and we're like, the one thing I love in movies or semi-bad movies or whatever is the obvious setup like that, or like when she's like, no, the sesame seeds, like all these little things that are like, oh, I wonder if that's gonna mean anything to me later.
I've never finished a screenplay writing, reading I have. I've never finished writing a screenplay, but I've always read, I've always heard about it, show but don't tell. There's so much telling in this movie.
It's all telling.
There's so much. There's one scene where he basically like finds a computer file and it's like the bad guy's plot or like all the crimes they did. And it's like a video, and he's just sitting there watching all of these crimes. And it's like, why would you just leave that on your desktop?
It's an orgy of evidence. It's every single thing he needs in one space. I love the moment, sort of the big key moment where there's the moment where he catches on to Tim Robbins that he's probably doing something bad is after he hears sort of like the last thing Teddy said before he was murdered. And then he Tim Robbins comes and sits with him. And Tim Robbins does a really good job of being, just kind of like charming and friendly. And that's my favorite type of villain, in these kinds of movies. And then when he just happens to say the exact same thing that Teddy had said was like, his last words, which kind of clues Ryan and Phillippe into the fact that he probably had something to do with the death of Teddy. I love that in that moment, it's like the first time in the movie where anything like really stylistic happens, where we get like that vertigo shot,
And
the
then there's like
dolly
a
zoom, and then it's like
montage, yeah.
a montage. And then like him screaming, it's like all subtlety gets thrown out the window. And I started pumping my fist. I was like, yes, this is exactly what I wanted in this type of movie. And that's definitely an
It is
example of telling
cheese.
too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's all telling. Yeah, it's all telling and it's all cheese. Right? There's so many just like aggressively cheesy. There's a sequence that we'll talk about when we get further into it that when I was watching it, I didn't remember it until I rewatched the movie this morning. That I don't remember that this specific like editing sequence where I'm just like, holy shit, this is terrible. Like this
Is
is
that
great, but
the beginning when when Tim Robbins is giving the speech and it's like intercutting
no.
with him in different positions? Oh, okay. All
No,
right,
it's
it's
the
later.
it's when he puts together what the satellite dish is.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great. It's such a that's something that's like sort of a soft spot about movies from this era for me. Is there was sort of this return of melodrama,
Oh
for a
yeah.
moment in the early 2000s. And sometimes I'm like, I'll take that. I'll take that over nothing. I like it's does something. And eventually by the end of the movie, I've bought into the movie's bullshit. I'm just like, all right, yeah, let's stick it to the man. Let's expose them. And it's like it's just the movie commits so much that I'm just like, yeah, why not? And it's like I'm along with it. I haven't checked that out.
Everybody in the movie is committing 100% to this bullshit. And which, if anything, hurt it might hurt the movie because the cracks appear so much more. The cracks are so much bigger when Ryan Phillippe is at the height of his power. When Tim Robbins is at the height of his power. When Rachel Lee Cook and Claire Forlani at the height of their power, as you know. As and Rachel Lee Cook as the manic pixie kind of, but not really.
I love that sort of misdirect with Claire Forlani and Rachel Lee Cook, where, Claire Forlani is his long-term girlfriend. Rachel Lee Cook is The girl that he's working with, everybody has a crush on. There's the guy who looks like the lead singer of Smash Mouth, who's just like, whoa, she looked at you, dude. And then, it's like there's an area of time where you think she's the good, or where you think like Claire Forlani's the good one, and then you think Rachel Lee Cook's the good one, and then it kind of goes back, and it like, yeah, it's a hat on a hat a little bit the way that it develops, which I really liked. And I found that so fun, it, genuinely unpredictable, genuinely, like, kind of the way it concludes, I was like, honestly, I didn't clock that is the way it was gonna go.
But not in a way that was not in a way that's necessarily, inconsistent. Like the dots connect for the, they do, maybe too much do they say, what's coming, but
Right. Within the diegesis of the film, it works. I want to talk about Ryan Phillippe, who I do frankly find to be like the weakest aspect of the movie, in terms of performances. I think particularly when he's in a scene with Tim Robbins. Tim Robbins is just, he's chewing it up, he's a master. And Ryan Phillippe's a little bit of like, he's a pretty boy. And I was just thinking watching this, like, if this paranoia movie was made in the 70s, this part would be like Dustin Hoffman or something, like playing that paranoia. And it's like, it is definitely a step down. I do think in the second half where he has to get a little bit more manic, that made him more interesting to watch.
I mean, he is his character is certainly written as the guy that things are happening to, less than the guy who is happening to things. And because of that, yeah, he does have to play, especially with Tim Robbins just earning a paycheck. In a
But
way that
not entirely phoning it in, not doing like a
no,
full De
he's
Niro earning a paycheck.
no, he's having no, he's there's something to be said about, especially playing villains, of just being given the freedom to just do whatever you want. One of the times when he gives the one of the times he gives the stolen code from a hacker that they imply or imply killed in a car accident. He's
Great things set up early on, like, oh, on the TV, a hacker died. I wonder if that's connected.
Yeah, it's all, what about the floods in Missouri that they say right before that? But he does that, and while he's doing that, he's eating out of a can of Pringles. And I like to think Tim Robbins was just like, "Yeah, I'm eating Pringles during this. We're just going to deal with it. I'm not interrupting my snack to film this scene."
And he's like eating them sloppily. He's sticking like multiple Pringles in his
Yeah, and
mouth
he's
at
like
once.
making crumbs all over,
Yeah.
But he does that, man.
That's business. That's what we call good business with an actor.
Yeah, but it's, and the disk drive that he plugs that into is separate from the rest of the computer. So that way it's the early aughts, late 90s.
Yeah, I looked up this director because I was interested in, like, I had never heard of this movie before you suggested it. And I hadn't heard of this director. I looked him up. He's a bit of what they call a journeyman. I think he directed Johnny English right after this, 2 years later.
Then he did Laws of Attraction.
Yes, yeah. So I feel like the moments in this where he really gets to shine is where it kind of does. He leans into this, like, I don't want to give it too much praise by saying this, but a De Palma-esque, type of like stylistic, bombastic moments. Like the one other one I'm thinking of is when Ryan Phillippe's kind of spilling everything, all everything he's figured out and what he has to do to Claire Forlani, and the camera's just like moving around them and swooshing around them really fast. And that's the peak of his performance. That's the peak of both of them. That's where it's like, I don't know what they're talking about, but they're so committed into the scene. I was like riveted.
I paid very close attention to the tech scenes this time around for the first time that I've ever seen this. I've probably seen this movie 4 or 5 times total. The software that they're developing, which again, by 2024 standards, is very funny that this is their thing, is a basically it's like it's YouTube more or less is what they're talking about, is a way to, it's YouTube mixed with Facebook, but without the social media component, just the interconnectedness of it. And Ryan Phillippe's character is there so that videos can download to phones quicker. Like that is the problem that they are trying to solve, is so
Because
that
it's
you can
showing up
download.
fuzzy.
It's well, because it's not coming down fast enough from the satellites. That's the software that they're trying to do is you know, it's like a video, it's like a media player.
And it's all window dressing where it's like, I'm like, all right, I get they're hiring him to do something with tech. Oh, there's something shady going on. Oh, a guy gets beat to death with baseball bats. I'm like, I get that. I understand. I understand that as an aspect, which also brings in one of the craziest parts and the way that this movie kind of keeps getting crazier and surprising me. When they frame two racists, like anti-Asian racists, for the death of Teddy, by spray painting, they spray paint "Die Chink" onto the wall. And I remember that, my jaw kind of dropped. I was like, oh my gosh, I did not think the movie
It's
was gonna go there.
it's all over the movie. It does, the movie has that late 90s, early aughts
Lack of
vibe.
sensitivity.
Not just lack of sensitivity, but like violent tonal shifts.
Because there's other times where it's like, oh, it's cool and it's slick, and then, oh, here's a horrible, horrible crime.
That they then show, that they later in the film show the video of the people committing. I mean, not explicitly. I think this is a PG-13 rated movie. You know, and there's no blood. It's a pretty overt. You know, it's a pretty overt thing that, again, considering the time period, nobody says it. You know, it just is. It's just like, oh yeah, that was a hate crime. You know, that's why the Asian
We were
character
warned
died.
about it. He mentions, like, we were warned about it, and then also the other thing that they just kind of throw in, I didn't expect, is the revelation that Rachel Lee Cook's character was molested by her stepfather, which is, I guess, it's part of this thing where they have dirt on everybody. They have like information on how they could kill them or how they could frame a death. And that almost kind of being a red herring when you find out that she's in on the whole thing, but it's like, that is one added detail that when that showed up on the screen, again, my jaw kind of dropped. I was like, oh, okay, we're doing that in the hacker movie.
It's another tell, don't show.
Right, exactly.
Here's some plot on the screen here. We're gonna let you read it for a second. Okay, now we're gonna keep going. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that's part of the montage when you find out that, you know, the Claire Forlani character is a plant, you know,
Yes,
like a
which
long.
I loved because it's so absurd. You're like, she's his girlfriend at the beginning of the movie before he meets Tim Robbins. We don't know how long they've been together. My brain was just going like, how long has she been assuming a different identity as his girlfriend? This entire thing, the moving parts have been happening for so long
Like a live-in
beyond
girlfriend. They're like
the movie.
live-in girlfriend at the time. It's not
Yes,
like we've been
they
dating for like a few weeks. Like they are, she is part of the team.
That she's they've supposedly been together quite a long time, which I love. I love that. It's so absurd to just go for that and go, oh, that's not even her real name,
And the funniest thing too about that is because this movie has so much gas in the tank the whole time, is that they keep in all of these in every all of the plot is spelled out except for a character, you know, somebody called ND47. And then he goes to the Richard Roundtree's the Department of Justice office, and while he's waiting for Richard Roundtree to, I don't know, finish his cigarette or coffee and come in and like take his statement, he's like looking at the pictures and see that Richard Roundtree played college football for Notre Dame and wore number 47.
And it says
Like,
ND47 on his jersey.
and it's like, you know, or North Dakota could see him play, you know, an ND school. I took that to mean though. I look at Richard, I gave him enough credit to play for Notre Dame. You know, Golden Domer. Not a NDSU Bison, but yeah, it's just gas in the tank. It's all gas in the tank.
It's all gas in the tank. A couple people I think I recognized. I think a young Patrick Wilson is one of the bad guys in the car. I might need to look into this, but I don't think he had any lines of dialogue.
One
But
of
I think watching it.
my and your favorite, I don't know about yours, one of everybody's favorite character actors, Ned Bellamy, is in it.
Yes, yeah, as Phil. He's good.
We
I
should
thought
all
he
have.
was, for a second, I thought he was Dan
Yep.
Castellaneta because they look alike. But yeah, yeah, I got Tyler Labine, a lot of like recognizable character actors, and you know, obviously Richard Roundtree and stuff. I was gonna say the plot twist, this whole revelation with Claire Forlani's character leads to easily my favorite scene in the movie, which does not have Tim Robbins in it, funny enough, even though I think he is the most interesting performance. The best scene, in my opinion, is this seductive, like tense, like this sexually tense Chinese food scene where she's made him like General Tso's chicken, and he thinks that she might have planted sesame seeds in it to poison him. And just like the tension of him checking it while she's upstairs changing, and then like asking for chopsticks and like scraping his arm with the fork. It's so well done. And the way that it ends in this like such a like De Palma, Paul Verhoeven like erotic thriller moment where she like dips her finger in it and then makes him suck it off her finger. And it's such a great moment. And then she says she loves him. And one thing, that's one brief moment where I felt like they actually showed and didn't tell, where she says she loves him, and there's that moment that's like, oh, she actually means that. She's admitting that she actually does love him, even though this has all been a ruse. And then the moment he says her real name, Rebecca, and she goes, yes, and then her eyes open, and then I actually out loud was like it was such a great conclusion to that scene.
There are so many. That's why I picked, one of the reasons I picked this movie and why I'm so enchanted by it is that there's these lightning strikes of brilliance
Yes.
sprinkled throughout this movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's there are these just you know the these scenes of just like really clever or really you know genius pieces. You know, and
Yeah.
then there's the scene where he's looking for the satellite dish that they're using to spy on people. And there's a misdirection because there's a lot of misdirections in this movie. They think it's in, he thinks it is in a under construction television studio.
Yeah.
So he breaks in and all he finds is a Pepsi machine. Which even if it's product placement is a very funny sight gag.
It is funny the way it
Right.
cuts to that after all the tension.
Well, and I feel like I've been in places where like I'm in like a warehouse or like a back room at like a box store or something, and you're like, oh, it's all concrete and ladders and mops and shit, and then there's like a vending machine in the middle.
Yeah.
There is something very truthful about that shot,
Yeah.
even if it's product placement. Like I relate to seeing a vending machine surrounded by nothing.
Perhaps the greatest set in this movie is the children's room,
Right. Well, and
where
so yeah, so
it's like all Lego.
yeah. And he realizes that the headquarters for the surveillance where they're sending the dish out is a sculpture of a mouse disguised as a dish. And when he's looking at it, it like cuts on the dish like three different times. And it's a mouse, and I think it has a mustache. It's so stupid looking. And he's just like having a staring contest with this thing. And I'm like, this is the worst 2 seconds of any movie. You know, how can you have so many smart things in this movie and then have this shot?
Yeah. Yeah, it's, man, it's one of those things where it's like, I want to give Peter Howitt the benefit of the doubt, right? I want to say he was probably, you know, handed the script that was in a that was probably in a drawer that was like, oh, hackers came out, hacking is big. What do we have that can do this? Here we go. And then it's like the moments that are really good are the moments where he really kind of pushed through and got something brilliant out of what was a pretty silly script, you
Did
know?
you look up
That's what I want to think.
the writer?
I did not look up the writer.
It
That's
was written
Howard
by Howard
Franklin.
Franklin, who also did some punch-ups on Romancing the Stone,
Oh. Yeah, I see that.
and then a handful of other things.
Yeah, larger than life, the man who knew too little. Yeah, also a journeyman, it looks like, you know, working man. And I was gonna say one of my favorite developments in the plot is the way that he finds an ally in the sort of blue collar ex-cop character who's not a geek. He doesn't know any of the tech stuff, but because he has this like automatic distrust of the company because he doesn't understand the tech stuff, he's on his side and he ends up helping him at the end, which is great.
It reminded me of that. There's that line in The Simpsons when Homer goes to college and he's like, I'm a jock, which means I need to hassle nerds. And like, that's kind of that, like that idea of the stereotypical like geek jock thing, because he calls them all geeks constantly, but the geeks all hassle him because he's a minority there. So there's that tension, you know, and it's stupid. It's all dumb. But again, it works out really well. And at the end, when they expose everyone, he's like, what did we do? And they're like, we won. And he starts yelling and stuff next to the Pepsi machine.
The way that he's at the end, just like, hey, is there anything I can do? And he's like, yeah, bring in a TV. Like that, just like that's all he's good for. But he helps, you know, the way that the unlikely allies build, I think, is cool. The way that Claire Forlani ends up helping him because she, you know, fell in love with him along the way. And the way that this sort of like, you know, hard knuckle old blue collar guy helps him just because he has a natural prejudice against all geeks. Incredible. It's a wonderful development in the story.
Again, none of it should work, and I don't know that it does, but it's if you think very little, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So do you think, would this movie be as important to you as it is if you hadn't seen it at that specific time in eighth grade?
I think for me, because it was something that I saw immediately within a year or so before me getting really into punk rock.
Oh, okay.
So for me, I borrowed London Calling from a friend when I was, I think it was between eighth grade and ninth grade. And the way, and I've discussed this at length on Mike Bobbitt's music podcast. So if you want more origin story,
Yeah.
for me, it was very much, you know, growing up as a dumpy kid in the suburbs who never felt good enough, you know, to hear punk rock, specifically classic punk, things like The Clash, the Dead Kennedys, the Ramones, things like that. The Descendants
Yeah.
speaks to me very openly about, hey, you know, you don't have a nice car and you look like hell and you know, girls don't get you and, you know, neither does really anybody else. You know, here's this thing that can speak for you and voice that, but also it has a lot of countercultural components. It has that DIY ethic and it has all of that ethic. Lines up with the Gen X, you know, anti-corporate window dressing and antitrust, you know,
Right.
so those two kind of get lumped, you know, that's able to kind of follow into, you know, that ethic that I immediately after watching this movie began developing.
Yeah. And that kind of brings about the double entendre of the title antitrust, right? That it's like a bunch of things. It's like a lack of trust, but also, you know, it brings to mind like anti-capitalists, like Teddy Roosevelt trust busting, like that. Pops into my head a little bit.
I think in Germany it's called conspiracy.com, which is 100 times worse.
Yeah, that's much worse.
It's much worse.
I guess one question is, do you th think there's a place for conspiracy thrillers like this today? Because I know that conspiracy theories in general are so hot. There's like an automatic culture war associated with conspiracy theorizing, because the loudest ones tend to be like, you know, QAnon or something like that. But do you think there's a place for something like this today to come out and not be like a hot button thing? Because I can't help but think about how, in some ways, how we've regressed, where it's like this movie came out and it wasn't like ruffling any feathers. People were like, oh, this is just a fun movie that kind of that uses some real life, you know, disparities or hot topics. But like, if it came out today, would it be too, you know, atomic, I guess?
I think that, and some of this is going to sound like a bit because it is part of a failed bit, just in, you know, as info. Conspiracy theories were so much more fun in the 90s
Oh, yeah.
because the stakes were so much lower and there wasn't a downstream effect.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody was a Bigfoot hunter, it meant that they were good at camping. If somebody was a believed in UFOs, it means that they were really into astronomy, and that's a healthy hobby. And nowadays the conspiracy theories are so much more mainstream and so much more,
Not fun.
yeah, they're not, they're much more to the word toxic gets thrown around a lot in today's workaday world, but they're much more toxic. I think surveillance thrillers in particular absolutely hold a place in our society because we're
Sure.
surrounded by things that are listening to us, and I don't think we think enough about that,
Right.
and we don't
Well, yeah, that
acknowledge it.
post-Patriot Act zeitgeist, right, where we have that understanding there.
Well, even from the consumer aspect, right? You say something, Google on your phone starts showing you that thing you said, right?
Right.
Or Alexas or door, the doorbells that watch people or whatever, right? Ring doorbells. We live in it's not even a surveillance state because it's the state does it, but it's also we do it to ourselves.
Yeah.
And to go a step further, even like you have the, influencers, right? Like it's a panopticon, but it's one that we foisted upon ourselves. And
Yeah.
I think that it would be, it's, there's certainly, and Black Mirror touches on it a little bit.
Yeah.
There was The Circle that came out a few
I
years
was going to
ago.
mention that where
Yeah.
Tom Hanks is the Steve Jobs
Yeah.
character in that one, right? Yeah.
I think it would be difficult to make a movie. I think while it would be fun to watch people try to make a movie like this nowadays, the culture war associated with Silicon Valley is so much more, so much hotter now
Yeah.
that, like, when Knives Out 2 came out, everyone was like, oh, that's Elon Musk. And he was like, only
Right.
kind of,
Yeah.
and I feel like it would be difficult to parody Silicon Valley nowadays without coming off as heavy-handed in a
Yeah.
way that would veer into preachiness in a way
Right.
that would turn people off.
Right. Yeah. I guess particularly the way that the war on terror has exacerbated, our idea, our understanding of mass surveillance, and it's almost like the elephant in the room. If you were to make a movie, a conspiracy movie about mass surveillance today, is like we know that that's used to like spy on mosques and stuff like that, right? So it's like there's almost this really hot button thing that we're intentionally not talking about if we make a fun paranoia thriller today.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it is done for fun. I mean,
Yeah.
if you watch somebody like, the movie Spy with
Yeah.
Melissa McCarthy,
Melissa McCarthy, yeah.
or the Get Smart movie version that they did with Steve Carell,
Yeah.
like the, this is the whole gist of it is he is a he's spying, he's an intel guy.
Yeah, he's an analyst in that, and yeah, and I think you're right. I think it would do good if like a fun movie like this came out or with this type of subject matter again, because I think that there may be is this sort of obligation people feel, that it's got to be like an Oliver Stone movie if you're gonna talk about something like that, but it doesn't have to be, it can
Well, and
great genre filmmaking. Oftentimes, dating all the way back to the 70s and the 60s, oftentimes did build on real life fears and the real zeitgeist, and there were ripped from the headlines scenarios,
yeah, when you mentioned De Palma, to me, that my mind with this goes straight to Blowout,
Yeah.
right? Of this is just a dude who's tied up with something, right?
Yeah.
That's where my brain goes with that. I think the problem too is they don't. Everything has to be about something nowadays.
Yeah.
And
It's got to be the
cheese,
movie of the moment. It's got to
well,
change something.
and cheese is so much harder to come by. And even things that used to be cheese are being turned into not de-cheesified in a way that really annoys me.
Right.
So like the and it'll be TV instead of movies, but to me the great example of this is the Criminal Minds remake or the
Oh,
reboot
I
they
haven't
did of
watched that.
so they did so I love Criminal Minds because Criminal Minds is aggressively not about anything.
Yeah.
And when you compare it to like Law and Order SVU, so many episodes of Law and Order SVU are about something. Whereas Criminal Minds is,
Yeah, SVU has always had a rip from the headlines type of
yeah.
aspect to it. Yeah.
But now, so even more aggressively, it's just like, this is the episode about this thing.
Yeah.
Whereas Criminal Minds will be like, we got a guy who turns people into dolls.
Right.
No,
Right.
marionette dolls, not just regular type. Right? So I love that. Like when you watch it, it's just so stupid. It's just
Yeah.
so dumb. But that's the fun of it, is that it's not about anything. It's just, it knows we are going to be really cheesy today, and we're just going to enjoy. You're going to have 45 minutes of not thinking.
Yeah.
And you're just going to have fun with this stupid bullshit. And then they did the relaunch on Paramount Plus, and suddenly it's about something.
Yeah.
And it's
Right.
like, no, I don't like, go back to the guy who's talking, go back to the guy who hunts people for sport. That's more fun.
Yeah, that is more fun. And yeah, making it about something, it's difficult and it requires more, right? It requires more sensitivity, it requires more nuance. And that's something I kind of like about like a lot of the older paranoia thrillers, like something like the Parallax View, right? Like it's something that is almost irresponsible in how it just kind of uses a sort of like deep-seated real paranoia and applies it to bigger, larger than life fiction. But in a way, I kind of admire that too. I admire the irresponsibility, the sort of like, yeah, let's just fucking go with it. And that's something that it's funny to compare this movie to the Parallax View because they're not similar at all. But that there's that type of reeling spirit in Antitrust that I like.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, it's still about things. It still has, good questions in it, but
Yeah.
it's certainly not on purpose. It doesn't feel like it's on purpose about something.
Right. It
But
helps. It's one of
there
those
isn't an
movies.
agenda.
Yeah, it's one of those movies where like if you already have maybe a punk rock spirit in you, this feeling of wanting to take down the man, wanting to return information or resources to the people, that definitely helps, right? Because that's definitely the backbone of the movie and the spirit of the movie. But it's not grounded in any type of like real issue, where it's like to them, that they were probably like, hey, dude, if Steve Jobs or Bill Gates was killing people, that's pretty wild. That's a fun story. And they're
Yeah,
not really trying to get at anything else beyond that.
that's a great setup, and everything else is just window dressing.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So before I move on to the Letterboxd reviews, do you is this at all like a movie you said you've watched it like 5 or 6 times now?
Yeah.
Do you is this a movie you regularly show to people? Is this something where it's like if you're getting to know me, this is a movie you have to watch?
No, not by a long shot. It's such a it, this is such like this is such a this is such like a lore movie. No, I showed my wife this a couple of years ago. Because I had friends that were geeks in high school, and like we had all seen this movie and talked about it periodically. And then kind of would bring it up as a joke, as time progresses, be like, hey, remember this movie we watched, because it is
Right.
a movie that is, I don't know if memeable is the right word, but it's definitely a dumb movie.
It's also crazy to show eighth graders in school, not like with some of the things in
Why was I shown this in school?
it.
Amongst many questions. Maybe I was a ninth grader, that time frame. This is one that I feel like I'll watch every few years.
Yeah.
Every few years I'll be like, oh hey, it'll like Max, so like some streaming service will be like, we have antitrust, and I'll be like, well, I guess I should watch that again.
That's a beautiful place for a movie to hold in your heart, I think. And I'm thankful you brought it on for the podcast because this is a movie that I never, under any circumstances, would have sought out on its own. And it's like the part of the fun of this podcast is watching something that I would have never otherwise watched, and I love that.
Kyle Forsyth used to have a music podcast where he would, the premise of it is that you would sit down and talk about an album that was good or interesting. So I picked interesting on my episode, and we did Fush Mu Young by Smash Mouth. And the podcast ended shortly thereafter.
Yeah, you took it down. You took it down like they take down Tim Robbins in this movie. All right, so I have a couple of half star reviews I pulled up on Letterboxd for Antitrust. This first one, half star. Probably one of the worst movies ever made. And what makes matters worse is I think it really is trying to be a commentary on corporate culture, which is wild. Tim Robbins, man, just goes hard in his roles, though. Love the effort, just not the result.
I mean, I think that's a misread. I don't think they're trying to say anything.
I don't think they are either.
Like,
This one's funny because I think they thought that I think they confused Ryan Phillippe for someone else. I'll read it to you. I don't think the good people at Lego had any idea what Tim Robbins and Justin Timberlake were up to in this computer affair. That's very funny. Just swap in early 2000s pretty boy for another one.
curly, it's all the curly hair and the kissable lips.
This one's really funny because it misses so much. Like, it gets so many facts wrong, but it is pretty funny. Half star. Bill Gates is racist and slaughters people with spies and peanuts. It's sesame seeds, but that's okay.
Yeah, most of the way there.
Also, I don't know if he necessarily was a racist. He just framed racists because he had to kill
Yeah.
an Asian.
Yeah, I don't think that the Gary Winston character does anything explicitly cancelable.
No, besides ordering the deaths of people,
Yeah,
you
but
know.
that's all, that's for business, not for
Yeah.
like an ethos.
Nowadays, he would have a podcast. He would be like the Jordan Belfort of our time. You know, everybody would be following him. There'd be a wolf pack following this guy.
Yeah, that's the thing I love about this is that it's about computers before so many awful things about computers happened.
It's all skepticism about computers.
It's
It's
all
all
this
that,
is
like, we don't know what this is yet.
there's no social it's a movie about computers before social networks, which means it takes place in heaven.
Lastly, is there anything else you want to say about the movie? What's your elevator pitch, I guess? If you're telling somebody to watch this movie, how do you introduce it?
An incredibly dated early aughts movie where Tim Robbins plays Steve Jobs if he was a serial killer.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And that's also a great, like, that's an intriguing way to word it too. If that was all I knew, I would watch it.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you coming on, Dan.
Yeah, thank you for
This
having
was
me.
fun. Thanks for introducing this movie to me. We're at the plugs portion of the show. Do you have anything coming up, anything going on that you want to plug?
You should submit for Motor City Comedy Festival if you haven't already.
Yes,
That's the
good.
big thing. I would appreciate, we're trying to cast as wide a net as possible to get the best comedians we can to come out and grace our fair city. So, please, if you've got a good clip or you got it's like lotto, you got to be in it to win it.
If you're in Australia, we already got a couple of you guys, so
No Zoom
heavy
clips.
competition.
Don't send any Zoom clips. We've gotten Zoom
Oh,
clips before. Don't send a Zoom clip.
gosh. Did Dat Fan submit the Motor
No.
City Comedy Fest? Anyway.
And you may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. And you may find yourself.